Mars Orbit. Chuck Jones let his arms float weightlessly up from the lander ascent vehicle's instrument panel. "Orbital insertion," he said into the headphone clipped to his ear. "Copy orbital insertion," came the voice of the mission controller back at the base. Turning to his co-pilot, Kristen Dvorak, Jones grinned and said, "Okay, let's unload the priest." Dvorak was a Czech, so diminutive she barely made the minimums for an astronaut. Like Jones, she was wearing a nanofabric spacesuit, although neither of them had pulled the inflatable helmets over their heads. Her hair was the color of straw, thickly curled. Jones kept his thinning brown hair trimmed down to a buzz cut. She slid out of the co-pilot seat and floated toward the cockpit's hatch. Jones went after her. "Never thought I'd preside at a funeral," he said as she slipped through the open hatch that led into the LAV's cargo bay. "This is not a funeral," Dvorak said in heavily accented English. "We are merely placing his body in cold storage until the next flight from Earth arrives to take him home." The cargo bay was empty except for a solitary cylinder, ordinarily used to hold supplies. Jones was almost too big to meet the specifications for an astronaut. He always thought about one of the first Americans to go into space, Scott Carpenter. When informed that the height limit for astronauts was 6 feet, he wrote in his application form that he was 5 feet 13 inches tall. And he got away with it. As they unhitched the cylinder from the straps holding it to the deck and floated it into the airlock, Jones mused, "You know, maybe when I die I'll have my body sent into space."
"Not buried?"
Dvorak asked. "Nah. Why stick yourself into the ground when you can go floating out to the stars?"
"Recycling," she said.
He shook his head. "I think I'd rather go into space." Dvorak smiled slightly.
"It makes no difference, really. Once you are dead, nothing matters."
As he swung the airlock hatch shut, Jones admitted, "Maybe so, but still." Once they sealed the inner hatch shut, Dvorak asked,
"Will you return to Earth on the next resupply flight?"
Jones said, "No, I'll wait it out."
"We will all have to go back sooner or later."
"I guess so.
I have applied for a job with Masterson Aerospace at Cellini."
"You want to live on the moon?"
"Why not? It would be more interesting. Not so many jobs for astronauts on Earth."
"I'll go back to Florida," Jones said. "After a year on Mars, I want some sun and swimming."
"More jobs at Cellini,"
Dvorak insisted. "More women in Florida," said Jones with a leer. "In bikinis." She smiled back at him.
"Higher ratio of men to women at Cellini. Intelligent men, scientists and engineers."
Laughing, they went back to the cockpit and launched the mortal remains of Dr. Fulvio A. DiNardo, S.J., into orbit around Mars. Book 4. Lifebringer. The old ones knew that life is not rare, but precious. Not fragile, but vulnerable. Life is as deep as the seas in which it was born, as strong as the mountains that give it shelter, as universal as the stars themselves. Yet life is always in danger, threatened by the very forces that created it, imperiled by the whims of coyote and the implacable workings of time itself. On the Red World, life was nearly extinguished by the howling sky demons. Yet life clung to existence. Life persisted. But slowly, slowly, the spark was guttering out. One day, inevitably, life would disappear from the Red World forever. Unless Lifebringer could return. Tithonium Base, the greenhouse. Jamie decided to hold the news conference in the greenhouse. He knew it was going to be grueling, but he wanted to show the viewers on Earth that the Martian explorers were safe and comfortable. Edith Elgin had volunteered to moderate the news conference from Cellini, for which Jamie was immensely grateful. She coordinated the reporters' questions and acted as hostess for the show. She relayed the questions to Jamie, who planned to respond to each one in turn, then wait for backup questions to reach him on Mars. It was tedious, but when the various segments were spliced together, the conference would appear almost seamless, almost as though it had taken place in real time. So Jamie stood in the greenhouse dome with the long hydroponics trays and their lush green plants behind him. Off to one side was Kalman Torok's little plot of a garden, tended now by Sal Hasdrubal and one of the new arrivals from Cellini. And up in orbit, circling Mars, Monsignor DiNardo's body waited for the fusion torch ship that would come from Earth and return him to the land of his birth. Edith's bright, youthful face filled the portable screen that one of the communications technicians had set up in the greenhouse. She couldn't look glum if she tried, Jamie thought, watching her as she introduced him and explained how the conference would be handled. To you viewers, she was saying, it will look like this is a real-time interview. But remember that Dr. Waterman is really on Mars, about 97 million kilometers from Earth, as we record his statements. Behind the screen stood a pair of comtechs running the cameras, and Vijay, her dark face serious, her radiant eyes fixed on Jamie. He tried to smile for her, then decided it wouldn't look right for the cameras. Serious, composed, distressed but determined, Edith had told him earlier, smiling encouragingly. That's how you've got to come across. Show 'em some of that Navajo dignity and strength of character. The first question was from the famous Orlando Ventura of Worldwide News. Dr. Waterman, we understand that Monsignor DiNardo had a pre-existing cardiac problem, yet he was allowed to go to Mars. Do you feel some responsibility for his death? Are you still beating your wife? Jamie asked himself. The screen froze on an image of Ventura's lean, sculpted face. He looks like a coyote, Jamie thought. The same cold eyes. Taking a breath, Jamie began, the medical consensus is that being on Mars had nothing to do with Monsignor DiNardo's death. He might have suffered a fatal stroke in the Vatican. Glad that there was no way for the interviewer to interrupt him, he went on. Monsignor DiNardo wanted very much to come to Mars, to help in the exploration of this world. I guess you could say he gave his life for that purpose. He believed that he was doing God's work, exploring a world and a people that God had created just as he created Earth, created us. He died in my arms, and I can tell you that he was smiling when he died. He was at peace. Ventura's second question, scripted days earlier, was predictable. Has Monsignor DiNardo's death forced you to reconsider the safety of all the other men and women on Mars? And if not, why not? So it went, for nearly 4 hours. Jamie stood there in the greenhouse, on Mars, answering their repetitive questions and trying to convince them, and ultimately their viewers, that the exploration of Mars was safe and important. Over and again he stressed the same points as he answered the same questions. Our base here certainly isn't luxurious, he said, sounding weary in his own ears, but it's comfortable and quite safe. As you can see, we grow a fair amount of our own food. We produce water from the permafrost underground. We get our oxygen from the Martian atmosphere. As much as possible, we live on local resources. One reporter wanted to know how much it cost to run the operation on Mars. Jamie forced a slow smile and replied, not nearly as much as Americans spend on pizza. And our funding comes entirely from private sources. No tax money is involved. At last it was over. The screen went dark. The technicians started to fold their cameras into their carrying cases. Vijay rushed around them and into Jamie's arms. You look like a man who could use a drink, she said after kissing him soundly. I wish we had some beer, he replied. They ate a brief, quiet dinner in the cafeteria by themselves, although Chang and several others came by their table to ask how the interview went. Jamie shrugged and said he thought it would be okay. It all depends on the editing, he said to each of the questioners, knowing that a clever editor can snip statements out of context and make anyone look foolish, heartless, or even malicious. Edith's doing the editing, he knew. She'll do a good job. But once the vid is in the hands of the networks, what will they do to it? Dead tired, he went with Vijay to their quarters. By the time they were crawling into bed, a message from Cellini came through. Thought y'all'd like to see the rough cut, said Edith Elgin with a gleaming smile. You did a good job, Jamie. Almost 2 hours later, Jamie decided that Edith had done a good job, too. The questions and his answers were now arranged in a clear flow.